This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Rhys Roth, director of the Center for Sustainable Infrastructure at the Evergreen State College. Rhys is also co-founder of Climate Solutions, a Northwest nonprofit working to accelerate solutions to global warming by galvanizing leadership, growing investment, and bridging divides. In 2013, he left Climate Solutions to form the Center for Sustainable Infrastructure. Rhys Roth is here today to tell us about his report, Infrastructure Crisis, Sustainable Solutions, Rethinking Our Infrastructure Investment Strategies. Welcome, Rhys.
Thank you, Diane. Glad to be here.
Would you like to begin by saying a few words about the Center for Sustainable Infrastructure?
Sure. I became increasingly interested in infrastructure in my last couple of years at Climate Solutions, to the point that when I launched a new career adventure, I landed in a focus on infrastructure. And infrastructure was intriguing me because these are the biggest capital investments that we make together publicly, and they have enormous implications for our economy, for long-term sustainability, our impact on climate change, our resilience in the face of the changing climate. And they're very long-lived investments. When we make these investments, they're going to be around and shaping the world of our children for at least a generation. They're 30, 40-year investments. So they're sort of intergenerational legacy that we create when we invest in our infrastructure systems.
What are the goals of the Center for Sustainable Infrastructure?
Primarily, we'd really like to see Oregon and Washington State become national leaders in infrastructure innovation, and to inspire and equip a new generation of infrastructure professionals to be able to innovate and bring a new paradigm and practice to the field of infrastructure.
What is the purpose of your report, Infrastructure Crisis, Sustainable Solutions?
Well, it really is to equip, inspire, support the innovators that are out there working in the infrastructure professions, the decision makers, the elected leaders who are making these investment decisions, to be able to shift from standard practice and really consider smarter, more affordable, sustainable, resilient alternative investments, and to be able to do that in the most effective way possible that will generate public trust, public support that's needed to make these kind of significant investments in our future.
What is the source of information for your report?
You know, I started in launching the center, I really wasn't an infrastructure expert by any means, so my first order of business was to go out and talk to the thought leaders and innovators in Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. My goal was to talk to 40. I ended up talking to 70 innovators and thought leaders from the region and just picking their brains in a formal interview. And so the report, this report that we're launching, is the distillation and synthesis of their insights in terms of what direction we need to go to shift how we invest in infrastructure towards smarter investments. So that's where my primary source of information was the brains of these people that are leading the new paradigm.
Well, we're talking about infrastructure, but what's included in the term infrastructure?
For the center, we're really focused on our energy systems, our transportation systems, all the water-based systems, so our water supply and drinking water, wastewater and sewage, stormwater, as well as solid waste, hazardous waste, all the waste materials that we throw away and we count on our local governments and utilities to haul that stuff somewhere and make good use of it.
What's the overall status of our infrastructure? Where do we stand now?
For most of us, infrastructure is invisible, boring. We don't really think about it. We just count on the lights being there, turning on when we need them, the water flowing and the shower working when we want it, the toilet flushing, all that. We just assume that's part of the world that we've inherited and we give it barely a thought. But within the infrastructure professions, there's recognition that our systems are aging. A lot of them were built out significantly in the post-World War II era. They're past their designed life. We haven't been budgeting enough money into our rates and taxes to properly maintain that infrastructure, especially as it's sprawled, because our low-density development is spread across the landscape. That's the most expensive kind of development to serve. And maintenance just hasn't kept up. And capital replacement, replacing the systems themselves as they age, hasn't kept up. So we've got a growing gap, a growing infrastructure deficit. And so that is sort of the crisis part of this, that there's really a day of reckoning coming as that deficit grows.
What are the likely infrastructure needs over the next decade or two?
Well, you could look at it at various levels. Globally, McKinsey & Company, the international consulting firm, says that we are going to need to invest planet-wide $57 trillion in the next 15, 17 years just to keep pace with GDP growth, not factoring in the need to swap out carbon-polluting systems, the need to increase climate resilience, just to keep pace with economic growth. Globally, we're talking about $57 trillion in investment that's going to be required. Along the Pacific coast, we're looking at, estimates are, $1 trillion in the next 30 years to keep our infrastructure operating, functional. You can quibble with the amount, but bottom line is we're talking about enormous amounts of money that are required. We really have no choice if we want our society to continue to function and our economy to hum along and operate as it needs to. We really have to have functioning infrastructure systems.
And where will the funding come from?
Well, that's definitely one of the challenges. Each of the infrastructure sectors has different funding sources, probably in all cases. That funding is connected to the volume of throughput. So in the case of energy, we pay an electric bill for our electricity, and a lot of the innovation is around using these resources more efficiently. And that's, in many cases, the smartest investment that our infrastructure agencies can make is investing in efficiency. But the challenge is that that reduces the electricity sales in the case of electricity. So our electric bill goes down, but the revenue goes down for the electric utility company, whether that's public or private. And so it's a bit challenging in that there's a sort of perverse incentive in that, boy, that's the smartest investment to make, efficiency, but that can reduce the amount of revenue coming into our utility. And that revenue is vitally needed to invest in renewing our system and investing in the long-term health of the infrastructure system. So we need to solve that. You see that also in transportation, whereas we're moving towards more efficient vehicles that use less gas, where more and more people, especially in our cities, are driving less, young people are driving less, and that is reducing the revenue from the gas tax, which is needed to restore and maintain our roads and transportation systems. So big challenge there in terms of rethinking the revenue model for our infrastructure systems.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Rhys Roth, Director of the Center for Sustainable Infrastructure at the Evergreen State College, and author of the report, Infrastructure Crisis, Sustainable Solutions, Rethinking Our Infrastructure Investment Strategies. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What are the drawbacks of the current approach to building infrastructure?
Well, the standard approach, the infrastructure engineers, and the engineers are doing the unsung hero job of keeping systems that are past their design lifespan operating and functioning, and we really take them for granted. So no criticism here of the great work that engineers are doing. But engineers tend to be conservative in the sense of proposing investments that are based on the past. It's worked in 1,000 cases across the country over the last several decades. This is a proven system, which works in a lot of cases, but it sort of systematically excludes innovation and new approaches. So probably the most important thing that we need to be doing is considering broader alternatives in the pre-design stage before we lock in on what kind of investment, what sort of facility is needed to address a particular problem, and consider broader alternatives. And then when we get a portfolio or shortlist of alternative investments, to run those through a thorough life cycle cost analysis, where we look at not only the upfront capital cost, but the cost to operate this system and maintain it over its lifespan. We'll be paying for these investments sort of like a mortgage over the long term, and so it makes sense to look at the costs and benefits over the lifespan of the investments. And then to take the triple bottom line approach, where we look at not only the cost to the silo, to the sector, to the utility that is either electricity, transportation, wastewater, stormwater, waste, but look at the costs and benefits of alternative investments to other aspects of government, to local government as a whole, and to look at the environmental costs and benefits. So there are innovative alternatives to standard practice that can show good economic return within the silo, within the sector, but also even better economic return to government as a whole, and even better return when you factor in social and environmental benefits to the community as a whole. So we're lacking that sort of, I guess, vetting of alternative investment strategies, that thorough vetting and the discipline around that that allows us to adopt innovations when they make sense.
In your report, you say that the future of sustainable infrastructure will increasingly blur boundaries between our energy, transportation, water, and waste systems to implement complementary strategies that benefit more than one system. Would you explain?
Yeah, these infrastructure systems tend to be very siloed. So, for example, energy people rarely talk to transportation people. And yet, the direction that, for instance, automobile technology is headed is toward electric vehicles. We could see a real tipping point over the next decade where electric vehicles become more attractive from an economic and convenience standpoint than gas-powered vehicles. That may be a decade out, but that appears to be coming. And it's difficult for people in the electricity industry, people in the transportation industry, to get their heads around that and to factor that into their planning. And there's not a lot of dialogue across those silos where people have developed expertise in one area, gotten used to the system that we have. And so it's a real challenge to stretch and grow and contemplate, what are the implications when we shift and create a new electric load, reduce gas load, alter our revenue models? So that'd be one example. Another example would be, a classic example is when we dig up streets in our urban areas. Our street right-of-ways are enormously valuable real estate. In a typical city, it might be 30% of the urban real estate is public right-of-way. And there are several infrastructure pipelines running through there, typically. There are wastewater pipes, drinking water pipes. There can be electric lines. It's a transportation corridor. And often, when there's work that needs to be done by one utility running one aspect of the infrastructure that requires disruption, digging up the street, work underneath that street, for example. It's not currently optimized, but there are communities that are really working to try to get better integration between, say, the transportation department and the stormwater department. So the city of Portland did a project recently, the Division Streetscape project, that brought together their water bureau or their Environmental Services Bureau, which deals with stormwater, and their Bureau of Transportation. They co-funded a project. They did new curb extensions for bus landings. They added crosswalks and streetlights and new on-street parking. And at the same time, they added bioswales along green streets, planted street trees, replaced sewer pipes, added public art. Overall, they made this a much more attractive main street for the neighborhood, better access to transit, improved safety and access for people on foot, people on bikes, people taking the bus, better flow for cars, and they significantly improved the neighborhood's beauty as well as its ability to absorb stormwater, and that delivered benefits to the stormwater system as well as the transportation system. So that's a beautiful example of bridging the silos to optimize the benefits for the community and to leverage two different departments' resources for the long-term strategy of bettering the community.
What most stands in the way of cross-utility collaboration? What are the challenges?
certainly there's a cultural challenge. These utilities and agencies have operated in silos for decades. They have their own management. They have their own mandates. They have their own design specifications. They have their own strategic plans and capital investment plans. And typically those are not coordinated with the other departments and utilities, even when their systems may be running right alongside each other along these street corridors. So just sort of opening up and figuring out how to bridge those, create conversations and collaboration and more joint strategic planning is a big challenge. And there are good reasons why an agency would want to have control over their investments and over their system. There's challenges of, boy, if I'm going to make an investment that is benefiting another department, shouldn't that other department be kicking in and helping to pay for that? How does it fit in that other department's strategic plan? It's more complex. We need to develop new tools for integrated planning that we haven't developed yet. We need to really develop that body of experience. Another challenge is that we have an aging workforce. We're going to see a wave of retirement. We're going to lose a tremendous amount of operational and system knowledge in these retiring professionals and engineers from across all of these silos. So there's an urgent need to inspire a new generation of infrastructure professionals to move into these various fields. And they can be trained and develop from the get-go the ability to work across silos. But we're not there yet. We really need to just inspire folks by the incredibly positive impact they can have on their communities for the long term by moving into these professions. Good paying jobs that really can have a enormous positive economic, environmental, and community benefit.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Reese Roth, director of the Center for Sustainable Infrastructure at the Evergreen State College and author of the report, Infrastructure Crisis, Sustainable Solutions, Rethinking Our Infrastructure Investment Strategies. So what are some additional examples of sustainable infrastructure that have been implemented here in the Northwest?
Well, you know, there's a small farmers irrigation district in Hood River, Oregon, that actually developed a technology for keeping the irrigation canals that are vital to the agricultural economy there free of debris, which can really cause problems in those irrigation systems. And they've developed a farmer screen that, rather than requiring the water to flow through a vertical screen, it's horizontal, and the water drops through it, and the debris just flows back into the river. And that is saving them a lot of money on operations and maintenance costs, making their water delivery more reliable during critical times for crops. And they have a lot of irrigation canals that are producing energy, and it is virtually eliminating downtime for those energy production systems and increasing power production. So that's a low-impact, clean source of energy coming from these irrigation canals. So that's one example of innovation that's happening. They're spreading that to other irrigation districts. Another would be the city of Spokane is facing a real challenge because they have their sewage and their stormwater systems combined. And when there's a big storm, the system gets overwhelmed. Sewage flows right into the Spokane River. And they were looking at a $450 million price tag to build a bigger water treatment system. But instead, they've gone with major investments in green infrastructure, green roofs, green streets, open space, investing in natural systems that can absorb that stormwater during those big storms. And it's enabling them to deliver a cleaner river faster at about a savings of about one-third of that cost. And they've done it. They plan these investments along with their planning for developing more walkable streets, more multimodal transportation system, and by integrating transportation and stormwater planning, they've achieved efficiencies and they're getting multiple benefits whenever they work on a given street segment.
To what extent are Northwest state governments addressing making infrastructure more sustainable?
You know, I think, frankly, that Oregon is quite a bit ahead of Washington in sort of stepping up to the challenge of developing a strategic approach to climate smart infrastructure. Governor Kitzhaber issued an executive order on infrastructure planning and finance. They've convened task forces of key experts that have done reports to the legislature on infrastructure innovation that has brought together some tremendous thinking around that. They've passed, in response to those reports to the legislature, they've passed enabling legislation. In Washington, we've had a series of studies and reports that identified the problem, the growing gap between the need for investment and the resources available, the lack of sort of strategic coordination and overall strategy. We've got a wide variety of infrastructure finance programs that run through the state, but they're not aligned under, you know, an overall set of strategic goals to move us toward affordable, sustainable, resilient infrastructure. So in that sense, Oregon's been more proactive, and Washington, I'm hopeful, will begin to move in this direction over the next year or two.
What should be our goals for developing sustainable infrastructure in the Northwest?
Really, I think it comes down to ensuring that these investments move us in the direction of building sustainable, resilient, affordable, and integrated infrastructure systems. So the environmental performance of our infrastructure systems can be massively improved. So that means minimizing greenhouse gas emissions. It means maximizing use of efficiency and conservation investments, tapping into locally plentiful renewable resources rather than imported resources, clean sources of water and energy and materials, little or no release of toxic compounds, and in many cases, particularly around the water infrastructures, investing in healthy natural systems can do the work of pipes and pumps more cost effectively than investing in bigger pipes, bigger pumps, and bigger treatment facilities for water and wastewater. So there's tremendous potential to benefit the environment on many levels. And at the same time, those kinds of solutions and strategies can help us be more resilient in the face of extreme weather that's coming with climate change and other natural hazards, man-made hazards from terrorism to other kinds of human impacts. These kind of investments can be both sustainable and resilient. And when we look at them over the life cycle, in terms of not only the upfront capital costs, but the cost to operate and maintain these systems over 30 years, oftentimes these systems are significantly more affordable and cost-effective when we do the economics right and deliver co-benefits across the community that are very attractive and that can move us in the direction of more prosperous, healthier, more beautiful communities that people want to live in and that can attract talented folks that can be anchors of our workforce into the future.
What's next for the Center for Sustainable Infrastructure? Where will you focus your efforts over the next few years?
Communicating the urgency of addressing the infrastructure crisis and moving in the direction of a new paradigm and practice of sustainable infrastructure is very, very important. Inspiring and helping to equip a new generation of infrastructure workers and professionals and engineers to move into this field is a top priority. Supporting innovators through associations, providing a clearinghouse of best practices, that's sort of an innovation clearinghouse, providing strategic consulting to agencies and decision makers that want to move in the new direction to help them move in that new direction. So all the things that are required to support innovation and to help the folks that really are going to move our communities towards smarter infrastructure investment, that's where the center is going to focus in the next couple of years.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I think we're going to have to spend billions upon billions of dollars just to keep our society operating and functioning. Our economy really can't work without properly functioning infrastructure systems. And the question is, how do we really get smart about how we invest that money? And there is enormous opportunity for innovation that can help solve some of the greatest environmental crises that we have that at the same time help prepare us for the changing world that we're facing and that are more affordable when we get the economic analysis right on these systems. But innovation and change is not easy. It's not easy when you have a sort of locked-in culture. So public support is vitally needed. We need to have the back of our elected officials and decision makers that are trying to move us in a new direction. We need to encourage our agencies to integrate across the silos and be very open to adopting innovation and sort of aggressive about pursuing opportunities for smarter ways of doing things. So there's tremendous opportunity and tremendous potential, and this is really important stuff. As boring as infrastructure and invisible as infrastructure is to us, we need to open our eyes to it and get engaged.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Reese.
Diane, it's been a lot of fun. I really appreciate it.
You were just listening to Reese Roth, director of the Center for Sustainable Infrastructure at the Evergreen State College and author of the report, Infrastructure Crisis, Sustainable Solutions, Rethinking Our Infrastructure Investment Strategies. For more information, check on the web at evergreen.edu/sustainable-infrastructure. Again, that's evergreen.edu/sustainable-infrastructure. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM. And KEXP.org.